Hello and welcome. This is Ad Positivity, and I'm your host, Laura Rabin. Today we are joined by Teodora Pavkovic. Teodora is a Singapore and New York-based psychologist and parenting coach who specializes in parenting in the age of digital technology. Her work draws from fields of emotional intelligence, attachment theory, and positive neuroplasticity, and her practical approach is informed by cognitive behavioral therapy and strategic intervention coaching. She has contributed to and been quoted in articles on platforms such as the Huffington Post, ThriveWorks, and NBC News, and has spoken at venues as diverse as schools, banks, co-working spaces, and museums. She is currently in private practice and also serves as a learning and development consultant with the School of Positive Psychology in Singapore. Welcome, Teodora. I've been looking forward to this interview for many weeks. We've had to coordinate and work through schedules and travel and work and holidays, but I'm so excited to welcome you and dive in now.
Thank you, Laura. Thank you so much for inviting me. Anytime I get the opportunity to talk about any of these things that you just mentioned before, like emotional intelligence and parenting and positive psychology, I'm always really, really excited and I never say no. So I'm very excited to be talking about this stuff. And I know that you have a bunch of very cool, very kind of thought-provoking questions. So I'm really looking forward to it.
Yes. So, well, let's start at the beginning. And let's hear how your early childhood experiences sort of shaped the narrative for your early life.
Sure. So the kind of the thing that I think of as the most interesting about not just my early childhood, but really childhood up until I was about a teenager, is that I was growing up as a third culture kid. And so I'm originally from Serbia, or when I was born, the country was called Yugoslavia. And then some not very nice things happened in the 90s, and the country broke up, and it ended up being Serbia. So it's present day Serbia, which is where I'm from. And I moved a lot when I was younger, and my family settled on the Middle East, on Kuwait, which was also a war-torn country for a while. And so on the one hand, there was this whole third culture element where I was growing up into very similar countries in certain ways. They both tend to have a more kind of collectivist type culture within both, but the similarities kind of ended there more or less. And so you're talking about very different religions, very different cultures, very different customs, just very different ways of being, of dressing, of doing so many things on the one hand. And then on the other hand, both of the countries that I spent most of my time in up until I was about 17 were dealing with very serious internal conflict. And so when you're a child, I think with most children, you don't tend to see those things as being overly dramatic, or you only really realize what you've been through once it's passed. So at the time when I was growing up, and I think my parents also did a pretty good job of trying to make sure that the family was doing as all right as possible given all those circumstances. But kind of in the aftermath, and now as an adult, I think I'm able to look back at that. And for the most part, you know, we were very lucky in that we really weren't affected very much, only a tiny bit, by the conflicts in the two countries we lived in. I know people who, you know, had lost family members and homes and all sorts of really horrible things. So we were really okay. But you do still wonder, especially in terms of my parents, what was the kind of resilience that they really had to show in the face of what was going on, and what were the kinds of coping mechanisms that they had to use, and what a good job they really did of making sure that that my younger sister and I still kind of had our childhood. They were still able to preserve our childhood and our innocence in a lot of ways. So I think of those things as being really important in terms of shaping me. I think definitely kind of one of the reasons why I'm so interested in emo diversity, in particular this diversity of emotions, and why I spend so much time thinking and talking about what people's inner emotional landscape looks like and why I'm interested in it in, on such a global scale, I think is because I was exposed to so many different cultures and lots of contrasting cultures from a very early age. And when you're very young, you know, the rules of behavior that your society and your community gives you, they're not very well formed yet. And so for me, I was able to very kind of fluidly and with a lot of agility accept all these different rules, especially the ones that were dictated by the different religions that I was seeing. To me, they were completely normal that, you know, in one culture, women were covered up for the most part, and that was just how they dress. That was just a normal thing. Whereas in the other culture, it was, you know, pretty much the exact opposite. It was very, very liberal. Both of those things existed in my world at the same time, and somehow they didn't oppose each other. Mm-hmm. And I think that's kind of the magic of being a child and of being that young, and that's why I tried to preserve a lot of that fluidity, I guess, of the child's mind in my own just personal life. But when I work with people and when I talk to people, I try to get them to think in those terms a lot. We lose a lot of that flexibility as we get older, as we get more set in our ways. And I guess one of the things that I'm very thankful for in my life is that I continued moving around a lot. And so I haven't really had the chance to become very set in my ways. I haven't had that chance to say, this is the right way of living, this is the right way of worshiping, this is the right way of eating or of dressing. I've lived in 9 different countries so far. Each and every country does all of these things in a number of different ways. So I appreciate that about my childhood. And like I said, when I look back on it, even though there was a lot of hardship, more so for my family members than for myself, I still think about it as being mostly positive. And I still like to think about it in terms of that post I don't want to say trauma, because again, I didn't experience any trauma, but we talk a lot about post-traumatic growth within psychotherapy as well, and how important it really is in the aftermath of a really big change or a really big trauma to really find meaning in it and to be able to find a lot of gratitude in it and to really be able to use it somehow as a learning experience. And I always try to look at my prior experiences, especially kind of childhood, early adolescence experiences as that. And then when I work with people on developing their own emotional intelligence and emo diversity and the self-awareness, I always try to help kind of get them to learn how to do that in their daily life, you know, as much as they're possibly kind of capable of doing that.
Mm-hmm. I think that's so important. I read an article that you talked about the 4 closest friends. And you touched on that just now, and how interestingly, as diverse as your friendship circle was, there was acceptance and an openness to learning and an openness to being, rather than, you know, us versus them. You know, I think I wish that was more the norm in the United States.
Sure.
I grew up in a big town, big city down in Miami. And so I also got a lot of diversity and a lot of exposure to different cultures and stuff. Mm. And I was raised to be open-minded and that sort of thing. And it, you know, what a difference that you know, when you can come to appreciate other people's cultures and, you know, kind of where they're coming from.
Sure.
You know, there's so much to be said about that. And when you're not able to experience that, it not only brings up feelings of fear and you know, other kind of scary things, fear of the unknown. And you just, it's so positive. And I love that you're doing this on a global scale, because there's so much for us to learn, you know, about the other cultures. I think that that's so important. So you mentioned emo diversity, and I know that you're, I know that's a big, important passion of yours. Mm-hmm. And explain to us, what is emo diversity?
Sure, sure. So it's a concept that I chose to talk about at last year's TEDx conference in Singapore. So this was 2018. And one of the reasons, or the main reason really why I chose to talk about that, wasn't because I was by any means an expert in that area. It was because I'd only recently found out about this concept, and I'd only recently discovered it because it hasn't really been around that long. And if you do kind of track the literature in psychology or psychotherapy, or even if you look at kind of pop psychology articles or books, it's still not really being able, or it's still not really being talked about all that much, which I hope will change very soon. I think we still need to do a little bit more research in the area and kind of understand it a little bit better. But some of the initial research that was done on this concept was done by, again, a very global international group of psychologists. And their kind of starting point in exploring this was this idea that if you look at our planet, some of the most diverse ecosystems or some of the most diverse environments in terms of the flora and fauna are the ones that thrive the most. They're the ones that seem to be the healthiest when there's a huge diversity of life and matter and chemical composition and so on. And so they ask themselves the question of, is the same thing true if we look at our own kind of inner landscape or our own inner ecosystem when it comes to our emotions? Is it correct to assume that if we have a real mix of emotions and if we have a very kind of diverse very diverse setup of emotions, that we are as human beings are also going to be healthier? And so they've done some research in it. Like I said, I think still more research needs to be done. But what I find really interesting about it is that it seems to indicate that if we really do make sure that we experience and kind of work through all of our emotions, both the ones that we like and that are very pleasant and very desirable, and the other ones that don't feel so good, that can be very uncomfortable and that we tend to maybe want to suppress, if we allow ourselves to experience all of them and try to balance them out, in the long run, that seems to have a kind of a protective effect on our mental health, so that we may potentially be less likely to suffer from more serious mental health issues like depression and like anxiety. And so the idea for emodiversity is really to experience that diverse array of emotions that we experience anyway. A lot of times when I do my workshops and trainings on emotional intelligence, and I talk to people about emotions like fear and like anger, emotions like envy and some other ones, although fear and anger are really kind of the most basic ones. I always like to say that we can't not feel these emotions. That's just not an option. In some exceptional cases, it might be if you're really an incredibly advanced practitioner of meditation, of different forms of mindfulness. You become able to control a lot of things about yourself. A lot of us have heard these stories of these monks who are able to control their blood pressure and their heartbeat. They're able to suspend their heart beating for certain amounts of time. So if you are exceptionally skilled at that, then yes, perhaps. But fear and anger in particular, I don't know if we have definitive kind of research on this, but I do think that they're some of the oldest, if not the oldest, emotions that we were ever capable of feeling. They were probably more along the lines of physiological states at that point, hundreds of thousands of years ago, as opposed to emotions in terms of how we think of them now. But they were emotions that made sure that we live to see another day. And there were emotions that made sure that we could protect our offspring, that we could find shelter when we needed to, that we'd kind of reach out and approach rewards and food and water and a desirable partner and so on. And so they were really the emotions that regulated our behavior. And we need to be thankful for that, because none of us would be here right now if it weren't for anger and fear. So we can't remove these emotions. I don't think we should be trying to necessarily. But I think we do need to figure out ways, of course, which all of humanity has been trying to do, probably unsuccessfully for many thousands of years, how to process these emotions in a healthy kind of a way, in a way that is healthy for us as an individual, that's healthy for our families, our communities, and so on the one hand. And then on the other hand, we definitely want to amp up a lot of these positive, pleasurable emotions such as awe, such as compassion, such as joy, such as excitement, pride, anticipation, the positive kind of anticipation, all of these other things. So that's really the idea behind emodiversity. And that concept is something that I've been working into all of my work ever since I did that talk, because I find that it can be an incredibly helpful, kind of framework which we can adapt and which we can work with, which can, to begin with, help us become a lot more aware of our emotions, which is, of course, the first step to being emotionally intelligent. Just this morning, actually, I did an online training with a group of HR managers in Singapore, and we were talking about these very topics. And I was saying to them that, Aristotle was maybe kind of the most ancient emotionally intelligent person, because he was quoted as saying that getting angry is an incredibly easy thing to do, but getting angry at the right time with the right person for the right reason is an exceptionally difficult thing to do. And we all know this, the number of times that we've kind of misplaced our anger or displaced it. So you end up yelling at your child instead of your partner, or at your boss instead of your mother, or, you know, whatever the case may be. So I think emodiversity, to begin with, gives us that opportunity to become a lot more aware of our emotions, to understand where they're coming from, to understand what tends to trigger them, what tends to cause them, to understand how they feel inside of our bodies. That's a very important thing, and something that I do with children as well. And I co-created a workshop series on this back in Singapore, the School of Positive Psychology, with one of my colleagues, from the School of Positive Psychology, where we really wanted to teach kids how to become aware of their bodies, of what emotions felt like in their different organs, in their hands, in their feet, and so on. Mm-hmm. And then once you have that level of awareness, then you go into really the most kind of advanced, I think the most kind of special and profound area within emotional intelligence, which is choosing how you want to feel and choosing how you want to respond once you do feel certain things. And that's where I think emodiversity is really a huge gift to us. And this is where I really encourage people to also become very aware of what their strengths are. And so I always recommend the VIA Character Strength Survey that was co-developed by Dr. Martin Seligman, who's one of the founders of the positive psychology field, where you get a list of 24 character strengths. So they're all strengths. So there's one of the things I love about that, and it's such a true to positive psychology surveys, that there's no wrong answer. You can't fail when you do this survey. So you get
What's the name of that list again?
VIA. So VIA Character Strength Survey, and it's a free survey. If you Google it, it'll pop up. If you have kids who are, I believe, 11 years and older, they'll be able to do the youth version as well, which is a really cool thing to do, because then you can also compare your strengths and kind of see how you maybe complement each other and so on. And then what I like to do with people is kind of coach them from that perspective of their strengths. These are kind of powers that they already have. It's not something that I or anybody else needs to teach them how to do or how to acquire. You already have it. And then once you have it, it's thinking about how can I spend more time within that space? How can I spend more time using those strengths? So in my TEDx talk, I mentioned one of my top strengths, which is the appreciation of beauty and excellence. And so that's one strength that I really like to use on a good day when I'm feeling great, but also when I'm not feeling so great. If I know that I'm feeling really annoyed, or I'm irritated, or I'm just sad and I'm feeling kind of maybe hopeless, or I'm disappointed or something like that, I love using that strength, because I know it's right there. It's always up on the surface. It's not something I have to dig very deep for. I can go to a museum or a gallery, or I can spend some time outside, or I can just read a book as well. Beauty and excellence isn't just a visual thing. For me, it mostly is. But it really rests in a lot of different things. It can be sound, it can be sensation, it can be taste, which actually reminds me of a book that I very recently came across. I'm very excited I did, because it's a new area of kind of intelligence that I was not aware of before. And it's a book called Aesthetic Intelligence, by a woman called Pauline Brown, who I also had the pleasure of meeting in person and having her sign my book about a week ago in New York. And it's a really interesting concept, because she's worked for a lot of luxury brands such as Louis Vuitton, a lot of makeup brands as well. You would assume that what she's talking about when she says aesthetics is just visuals, mm-hmm. what something looks like. And that's exactly not what she's talking about. So when she talks about aesthetic intelligence, intelligence. She's talking about how things make you feel, what things make you think about, what kind of a physiological state they put you in, how do they activate your senses. And so I love that concept of aesthetic intelligence, because I think a lot of us have plenty of it. I think many of us could definitely not even learn about it. It's not so much a cognitive thing, but I think just it's just something to notice a little bit more. One of the activities that I also always like to recommend to people in terms of becoming a little bit more mindful and a little bit more focused is doing a very simple mindfulness activity where you just notice what your senses are detecting in that moment. And it's a very well-known activity. So you list a few things that you can hear, that you can see, that you can taste or smell or touch. And it does a really amazing job of just really grounding you and bringing you back into whatever your experience is in that moment. And so I like to combine a lot of these different things. I think they all do speak to more or less the same thing. They all basically speak to the human experience, which I think is what emo diversity is about. It's what emotional intelligence is about. It is what aesthetic intelligence is about. I've just started reading the book. I'm about 30 or 40 pages in, but I'm very excited about it. And I'm excited about using and kind of incorporating that concept into my work. And then the other kind of more new or fresh kind of concept that I also focus on a lot is digital. Yes. Intelligence as well, because I think it's such an important part of everything that we do. And just earlier today, actually, I went in for an eye exam, and the woman asked me how much time I spend on screens, which is typically the question that parents ask me in terms of how much time should my child spend on their screen. And my initial reaction the answer I wanted to give the ophthalmologist was, oh, I don't spend a lot of time at all, because, you know, surely I'm aware of how detrimental the impact is. But then when I thought about it, I realized I actually spend a lot of time, and it's a lot of different screens, because I'm doing different things on my different devices. I do part of my work on my laptop. I do a part of it on my tablet. Then I do other things on my phone. And so, again, this training I did this morning online with a group in Singapore, we were talking about resilience and we were talking about emotional intelligence. But I always weave technology into all of it, right? Because I think, yeah, technology is just so it's infiltrated our lives in such a slightly sneaky way, and in other ways in a very over the top way. But it's become, you know, so seamless, as a lot of software engineers like to call it, that you're not really aware of its presence a lot of the time, but you're consuming so much of its content, and so much of it just kind of jumps out at you, that it is jerking around your emotions on a minute-to-minute basis, especially if you're using things like Instagram, for example, where, you know, again, a picture is worth 1,000 words. I think sometimes a picture can be worth 1,000 emotions as well, because, and again, I always share this example. I heard, I think it was at one of the workshops I was delivering, that one of the women there had actually unfollowed one of her girlfriends, because her girlfriend at that time was at this, you know, incredible dreamy holiday. And this person just couldn't handle seeing these pictures. It was just too much for her. You know, she was experiencing FOMO and envy and jealousy, and her self-esteem had plummeted, and all these things had happened. So she told her friend that she would just have to unfollow her for the duration of this holiday. And once she was back into her, you know, crummy, everyday, boring life, the same that we all do, then she would follow her again. So I think there's a huge amount of awareness that I try to help people achieve when it comes to not just how they use technology. It's not really about our active use of it. It's those more subtle ways in which it impacts us. And most of the time, I don't think we actually realize how much it does it. So it's a bunch of different intelligences really that do feed back into this concept, I think, of emo diversity. And I'm not a professor. I'm not a researcher at any university. So I just keep hoping that some researchers somewhere will pick up this topic again, and we'll do a little bit more research on it, so that we can then take that information from them and then really implement it in a practical way with people. Because I think there are a lot of useful things that we can do there, and a lot of useful kind of approaches and techniques that we can then share with people that they can implement in their everyday life.
Well, and especially for people that are used to dealing, or they kind of always gravitate toward the big five or six emotions, right? I think I read that you mentioned something about, you know, some of these some of these stress, depression, anxiety, it's so overgeneralized.
Yes.
And that you need specificity and granularity in your emotions. And, you know, when people don't realize how they overgeneralize until you point out, you know, you mentioned the UC Berkeley study that there's 27 additional emotions. Yes. And once you start pointing out and are able to explain what awe feels like or what anticipation feels like, you know, empathic pain and that sort of thing. Once you once you have that awareness that these other diverse emotions do exist and there's a name for them, then you can really delve inward and and sort of analyze the feelings and the physiological reactions that you get from those emotions.
Absolutely. Yeah. And then you kind of know what to do about it. Because again, some of those final stages or the final components of being emotionally intelligent is knowing where that emotion comes from, and then knowing what you're going to do with it, knowing how you're going to kind of respond in reaction to it. One of the tools that I always recommend people check out is called the Atlas of Emotions. And it was developed by the kind of the EQ father-daughter duo, Paul and Eve Ekman, who've I mean, Paul Ekman certainly was the person who kind of defined that we have common emotions that we all read in the same way on our faces. And he did a lot. Some of his findings have been challenged, which psychological findings always are, generally scientific ones always are. But he's really contributed to the field in huge ways and did that research cross-culturally. And so his himself and his daughter, with the support and blessing from His Holiness the Dalai Lama, developed this website called the Atlas of Emotions. And I believe they're now working on a children's version as well, which I think is so incredibly valuable. But if you go to that website, you'll be able to see the kind of, I think they also keep the five as the main five emotions. So we have anger, fear, disgust, sadness, and joy. And you can click onto each one of them and kind of see the architecture of each one. Mm-hmm. And you can look at these kinds of scales that they have for each one of our emotions, where you can see that sadness, for example, at its very kind of lowest intensity state exists in the form of, say, disappointment. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, as you amp it up and you go all the way kind of to the extreme, you're talking about emotions such as misery and such as grief. And so, of course, it's incredibly important that if you are experiencing sadness, you're able to differentiate between, okay, I'm kind of disappointed, or I'm feeling sort of hopeless, or I'm in misery, I'm grieving right now because I've lost a loved one or someone who's close to me, or I've just seen a catastrophe happen on TV. And again, like you were saying, that kind of empathic pain that we feel for people sometimes. Or if you look at fear, it's very important to be able to tell the difference between, okay, I'm kind of apprehensive right now, as opposed to I'm terrified. Right. And again, for anyone who does a lot of kind of public speaking like I do, will appreciate how important it is to know the difference between those two things. For a long time, I wasn't able to tell the difference between those two things. And so my reaction to preparing to speak just at that TEDx talk, which is only about a year ago, a little bit over a year ago, tended to be incredibly intense, because I wasn't quite able to define it and to really look at it and to say, okay, there are different levels of fear, and this one is all right. I can handle this one. Here's what I need to do. And so when you go into that problem solving level, where you look at how can I manage my emotion? How can I self-soothe? How can I cope? You also need to know what that emotion is, because you won't use the same intervention when you're grieving and when you're disappointed. They're two very different things. And this is, again, why I feel it's so important to talk to children about emotions, so that you're really starting from a very early age, so that they can tell the difference between, you know, I didn't get this toy and I'm disappointed, as opposed to I didn't get this toy and the world is about to end, and so I'm going to fall apart here right now because this is how intense this is. They still may fall apart even if you teach them how to label that emotion correctly, but at least they have some sense of, you know, my fear can be different and it shows up in different forms and different situations and circumstances make me feel in slightly different ways. So it's really important to be able to know how to name all the different ones. It just, if nothing else, it just makes life a lot easier because then we know what to do about it.
Right. And you know, educating the parent, educating the child on the labeling, because the emotional regulations within the brain are still developing at these young ages.
Of course, so yeah.
If they can learn how to properly, you know, understand and react, you know, it seems so much more of a healthy situation.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And one of the things, again, I think our listeners probably won't be able to see us, but if they're listening, I'll try to verbally describe what I also kind of talk to my participants about when I do these workshops, and when I talk about a few of the reasons why we have a hard time labeling our emotions and then regulating them as well. You know, if you take your two thumbs and you kind of put them on your temples on each side, you're kind of pointing into what we consider to be the emotional center of the brain. The brain is specialized. It's not quite as specialized as we kind of describe it to be sometimes, but it's just easier, you know, for the sake of talking about emotions, it's easier to label it that way. So yeah. So if you put your thumbs kind of right where your temples are, you're kind of pointing towards where that amygdala is, you know, the bad boy of the brain, the one that gets into all the trouble. And then if you take your index fingers and you touch your forehead, that is your executive center. That's where the control center is. That's the one that tries to kind of control and inhibit the emotions. So if you look at that distance, if you take your hands away, you know, between your thumb and your index finger, that's a very short distance. I mean, you're not talking about a whole lot there. But in terms of your brain, that's miles and miles away. That's an incredibly long way for a signal to travel that's going to say, calm down. You're not going to get the toy today, or you're not going to get the marshmallow right now. You're going to get it in 30 seconds, in 20 seconds, in 10 seconds, because our brain consists of you know, gazillions of brain cells.
Right.
To use a very non-scientific, non-existent term, but there's a huge number of cells in there, and these messages need to travel through a whole kind of path from one area to the other one. Mm-hmm. And that's why mindfulness can be such a helpful tool, and kind of stopping, pausing, noticing, becoming curious about what's going on can be so helpful, because some of the research indicates that practicing those kinds of habits of being mindful and aware can kind of build bridges or build roads, mm-hmm. between those two parts of our brain, between that middle, very, very old, kind of ancient, emotionally focused part of the brain, and that kind of uniquely human, more in control, more aware part of the brain that can actually pull the brakes and say, hang on a second, you know, is this really as bad as I think it is? Or do I really need to have 5 cookies right now? Or, you know, will I still be alive and be okay even if I have just one? So so that's one of the reasons also why it's so hard for children in particular to be able to tell us how they feel. And I think this speaks a little bit to some of the expectations that we have of kids. I think oftentimes we overestimate kids, and sometimes we underestimate them. And in both ways, it really does them a huge disservice. Mm-hmm. I think we expect them to be a lot more aware of their emotions and in control of their emotions than they are. And we expect that from them from a very early age. But I think oftentimes we underestimate their cognitive abilities and their abilities to be very thoughtful about things and to think things through and to have a sense of responsibility and a sense of awareness and consciousness. I'm currently working on a series of blogs that I'm doing with parents who are already implementing very mindful ways of using technology with their children, because I want to share them with parents. I don't just want to be the one who's telling parents what to do with their kids. That never goes down very well. I want them to see examples of what it looks like kind of in the real world, and that it is possible. And so I had one of the moms I was talking to who was talking about her 8-year-old son. They have a rule that he's not allowed to watch any ads of any kind anywhere. And so the rule that they've created is that if he does come across an ad at some point on, he doesn't have any of his own devices, but on somebody else's phone, or, you know, while he's there at home watching TV, he needs to ask a responsible adult that's there, is this an appropriate ad for me? Or he needs to turn away. And he does that, whether he's with his parents or he's not with his parents. And so she has said that a bunch of times he may be in another room with a friend and they may be on a tablet. He'll run out and he'll say, "Mommy, there's an ad on the tablet. I don't know if I'm supposed to be looking at it or not. Can you come see it?" Yeah. Typically, if you tell an adult, an eight-year-old did that, they'd say, please, that's, you know, that's science fiction. There's absolutely no way a child can do that. But kids can do that when we place that expectation on them. And not just that, but when we explain to them why we expect that of them. And that's one of the, I'm very excited for, I need to write up these interviews that I've done. There's just so much information in them, but I'm so excited to share them with parents because there's so much helpful information there. And I think it gives a lot of hope that really when you have those conversations with your kids, when you talk lots with them, when you explain things to them, when you help them understand how things like ads, for example, work, what's the purpose of ads, what are all the little tricks and tricks and things that creators of ads try to use, and you turn kids on to that, they'll understand the mechanisms that are at play. And then when you ask of them to do something like be very thoughtful about the kinds of ads they watch, they will buy into that idea and they really will take it seriously, and they will come out and ask you, am I supposed to look at that? Because they take it seriously. It's not something that you've said, you are not allowed to look at this ad because I said so. It's not about that. Again, when we talk to kids that way, we again tend to activate that mid emotional part of the brain. We get them worked up because we're worked up, and then you can't really get anything done. You can't get any information across to them. They're just not going to be on your side. If you try to activate their frontal brains and you try to talk to them about things and you try to pique their curiosity and you for example, point out lots of different ads and you ask them, why do you think they did this? Why do you think they used this character? Why do you think this was the language they used in this one? They love that because you're asking them for their opinion, and kids want that desperately from a very early age, not just when they're kind of tweens and teens. They want their brain stimulated, and they want to feel like they're important and like they have an opinion to give and to share. So kids can do incredible things. I think it's really down to us to reposition our expectations of them and to try and make sure that we really do encourage them as much as we can, that we really try and get those cognitive juices flowing, and that we do trust them to take care of themselves a lot more than we do. I think now in particular, we're seeing, unfortunately, for a lot of very good reasons, that parents are often parenting from a place of fear, which unfortunately gets in the way of really trusting their kids and trusting that they're capable of making a lot of important decisions for themselves.
We were talking about when we are connected to these devices and there are ads and you know, how the marketing and how they're just trying to prey on your senses and get you to buy that, whatever it is.
Sure.
What are some suggestions with how to even balance technology use in general and those face-to-face connections that we're losing? What's your advice for, say, kids or for parents of the kids, and then also for the grown-ups?
Like, sure.
Share some of that.
Yeah, we need that too. We need that too in a very big way. One of the things that I really loved at this at Pauline Brown's book launch that I was at on aesthetic intelligence, one of the things that she was saying, because she was talking about digital as well, right? Especially if you're talking about luxury brands, for example, marketing is a very huge part of what they do. And so you can't really ignore the digital aspect of it. And somebody, I forget what the question was that they asked about from the audience, but what she was saying is that when we're using our digital devices, whatever kind of screen-based device, at best, you're maybe stimulating and activating about 1.5 of your senses. And what you're really doing is you're actually numbing everything else. And so I think, again, this question begins with awareness. And actually, and I think, by the way, we all instinctively know how good or bad tech use feels. That's not something that anybody from the outside has to come in. Like, I'm not going to be able to tell you better than you know how good or bad your tech consumption feels. You already know that. But I think the first thing is just really to tune into that, to again, for me, the starting point is always the emotion. What are the emotions that you go through as you're consuming technology on a daily basis, as you're consuming Facebook or Twitter or Snapchat, whatever the platform is, as you're ordering your groceries from Amazon, as you're, you know, keeping track of your schedule on Google Calendar, as you're emailing, as you're doing, how are you feeling? How often do you feel like you're stimulated in a positive way, like a lot of your senses are stimulated? How often do you really feel like you have connected with the other person or people? Mm-hmm. I know one of the big ad waves for Facebook right now, in the US at least, that or in New York, that's the case. I don't know globally what it's like, but they're starting to focus a lot more on groups. And so I think the tagline is something like, there's a group for everyone. And so they're really trying to reshuffle, I guess, their image, which is going to be a hard thing to do right now for them, unfortunately. But they're trying to again make it more human centric and try and make it about, we're trying to connect
and build
people.
Connections.
Exactly. Right. Yes. And so again, I think anytime a tech company tries to tell me how connected or disconnected I feel from people, I get very kind of like a hedgehog. Just my needles all go up because it really irritates me. I trust people, not platforms, to tell me how connected they feel. And so that's the first thing I always ask people. How do you feel when you're using your technology? Do you feel good or do you not feel good? If we're just going to use kind of the most basic phrases, is it good? Is it bad? A lot of times I know for myself also, there really are times when I just feel like I do not want to be on this thing right now. I don't want to see another headline. I don't want to have to click on another thing. I just don't want to do this.
So
I don't like it.
It's noise.
There's a lot of noise. Exactly.
Distracting and
yeah, exactly. Yes, it's constant. It's really constant. Mm-hmm. I forget the name of this account or this profile on Facebook. I think it's a couple of guys who've been doing this for a few years now, where they've shown. I think they do it on an annual basis, or maybe they even narrow it down to kind of per minute, how many emails are sent, how many tweets go out, how many, you know, all these different things, and all these different companies, obviously, that own all these different platforms. Mm-hmm. And that goes into this concept of the attention economy that we're all in. All of these brands need our attention because that's just the structure of their business models. It doesn't work otherwise. So make no mistake, your attention is being dragged and pulled and sucked in every which way, right. Because that is the only way that these companies can survive. So really that's the first thing to kind of do. Look at what your digital landscape is like. What do you spend a lot of your time doing? And how do those things make you feel? Do you actually enjoy them? Do you like them? A lot of the teenagers that we survey and that a lot of different kind of big nonprofits do these polls with on a relatively frequent basis, which is amazing, will report that they do enjoy using their tech to connect with their friends. Mm-hmm. And if there is enjoyment there, and if there is a connection there, and if there is an exchange there that's meaningful, that's amazing. And those are the elements of it that we want to preserve. When I was a teenager, kind of in the late 90s, early 2000s, I would come home from school, you know, where I would have spent the whole day with my friends. And then as soon as I get home, I'd get on the phone and talk to my best friend again, mm-hmm. even though we had just, so it was a tech-based form of contact. But to me, I felt connected at that point, even though I was, all I could hear, right, was her voice. Mm-hmm. And even then I would have my mom come in and say, why are you on the phone? What are you doing on this phone? You've been on the phone for 2 hours. Surely you just talked to her. And so I think when it comes to kids, we really need to be very aware of how desperately important connection is, and they will find connection wherever they can find it. And at the moment, it is via a lot of these devices. So we need to just make sure that if there is really true connection being experienced and felt there, if there is an exchange there, if people do feel closeness through their tech, that we preserve those elements of tech, because those are the things that I would, or the ways in which I would consider technology to actually have that humane component. So, right. So I think that's really the most important thing. And in that sense, I always leave it, I'm kind of a guide and a coach when it comes to that, but I leave it up to people to sense in themselves where tech use is comfortable and where it isn't comfortable. And to me, really, a few months ago, I spoke at the Humane Tech Conference in New York. And one of the questions I was asked was, what is humane technology? What does that mean to you? And to me, humane technology means technology that knows how to make itself scarce when we don't need it anymore, so that it gets out of our way, so that it lets us humans, be human. So, So if you do find that you're fed up of using whatever it is, it's Facebook or Twitter, or you find that you're just fed up of using WhatsApp or Viber or iMessage to communicate with people, don't do that. Find a different way to connect with them. I have a few friends. I'm a member of the Digital Wellness Collective, which is at this point, a global community of professionals in this space, similar to myself. And I have a few friends who are members there who kind of refuse to use WhatsApp with their friends, because what they say happens is by the time the weekend comes around and we see each other, we have nothing to talk about anymore, because I already know everything that's happened, because I learned, second by second, what was going on. And so a few of these friends of mine have just kind of very nearly stopped using WhatsApp. And they say that once we do meet up on the weekend, we talk and we talk and we talk and we talk, because then I can say, so what happened to you? What went on this week? Right. And so that's really what it's about. It's tweaking some of those habits that we have. It can be very difficult. And sometimes some people need more help than others. Anytime you built up a habit, it can take you a while to then disengage from it and get yourself practicing other types of interactions, right, or whatever it is. But one thing that I always like to tell people is don't be afraid to drop the tech. Don't be afraid to leave it. I know it can be a very scary prospect. Even to me, a lot of things have been happening lately with Facebook in particular. A lot of these things don't align with my own values. They're not the kinds of things that I would want to recommend anybody else be a part of. I really don't like it. And I feel on a kind of gut instinctual level that I don't want to be a part of that. I don't want to encourage that kind of behavior. I don't want to promote it. I don't want to be a part of it. But at this point, to me, it seems like a very difficult thing to do, to disengage from it completely, which some people have had. And if people feel that way, they definitely should do it. But, mostly for work reasons and things like that. And also because I am a third culture kid, I don't really have another way to connect with a lot of my friends except through Facebook. And when Facebook first came out, I was incredibly grateful for it, because I thought how wonderful it is that I can still stay in touch with some of my high school friends and friends from college, friends from grad school. I think it was such an incredibly, it really was a connector in those early days in particular. So I think it's important that we really tune into our own emotions, how our tech consumption makes us feel. If we are finding it to be incredibly distracting, there are, of course, if we want to kind of use tech to solve tech related problems, there are all kinds of ad blockers, there are parental controls and apps that we can install. Again, I always like to encourage people to try and use themselves as the controller, not necessarily try and use another app to control another app. So if something as severe kind of as a detox is something that you feel you want to try out, then by all means, sit down, plan out what that would look like, make sure that you get your allies in there, get some friends or family members to be in on it. And when it comes to managing your children's tech use, that could be kind of a whole other conversation. But I think basically, it's a very similar concept. Again, it's really talking to kids. It's first of all, the first thing I like to tell parents is, and again, this is something I'm learning now from doing the series of interviews, is please don't be afraid of setting limits. And please don't be afraid of implementing your value system, and kind of what you want for your child and what you want for yourself and what you want for your family, kind of atmosphere and your family unit. Again, I see a lot of parents who are very scared of doing that. They know what it is and they know what they want to do, but there's a kind of blockage there. There's something that's stopping them from taking that step. And the one thing that I've heard from all of the moms so far that I've interviewed is phrases like, in our home, we don't do ABCD, or even outside of our home, we don't do ABCD. So that again, their kids now are in the habit of, if they're at, and these are all boys, it just happened, I didn't choose them that way, but it just so happens that they all have boys of around the same age as well. But all of these boys know that when you're in somebody else's home, in school, it doesn't matter where you are, violent video games and computer games are not something that you play. You just don't do that. Right. And again, a parent might assume that what the kid would do in that case is be sneaky and try and go around and try and spend time at friends' homes, friends who have, who play Minecraft and who play Fortnite and who play all these different things. They actually don't do that. In this case, what these moms have said to me is that with time, those friends who have started to become very hooked on tech and who spend a lot of time playing games, their sons have stopped playing with those kids. Mm-hmm. They don't like being around them right. anymore, because they'll come home and they'll say, all, you know, Jimmy wanted to do was be on his phone, and I don't want to do that, and I'm not supposed to be doing that either if it's, you know, a violent game or something like that. Right. So again, it's trusting yourself to really say, these are the, and you can, you know, if you want to, you know, a lot of these family contracts have become really popular. I think they're a wonderful thing that you can do. You can put it up on your fridge, you can mm-hmm. laminate it, you can decorate it, you can bedazzle it, you can do all sorts of things with it to make it a little bit more fun. But something that you create together, where you come together as a family and you say, this is kind of how we see things. This is mm-hmm. what we want to implement. We don't agree with, say, violent games. We don't agree with advertising to children, especially below a certain age. We don't believe in social media before the age of whatever it is. And again, another nice tip that I got from a friend of mine is always push that age. So, you know, make it really far away, so that then if you need to, you can bring it down, and then you turn out to be the hero. Yeah. So I love that tip as well. But really come together and talk about how you see mm-hmm. things. And again, explain to kids what things like persuasive design are. This is why this day and age, I really feel that we all, not just parents, we all need to know what these things are. Yeah. Because in a lot of instances, they are being used against us. In a lot of ways, they're used to help us. Things like, you know, health related apps and weight management and things like that, and really trying to improve your behavior for the better. But mm-hmm. a lot of the times they're not being used for that. And so I think we all need to know what these things are. We need to explain to kids what these things are. We need to also ask them, how do you feel after you've played 24 hours of Minecraft? Mm-hmm. Do you feel good? Describe to me what your body feels like, and what your tummy feels like, and your lungs and your heart, and what's your breathing like, and what are your eyes like? What's your head like? Does it hurt? You know, really get them again to tune into their bodies and to understand the effect of tech use. I also always like to encourage parents to just use the concept of consumption and yes. to compare tech to food. Yes. And there are a lot of really, again, great people in this space who use this kind of imagery and this approach when they do work with parents as well. So really thinking about it in terms of their different categories of foods. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that every single family will have rules for this type of food is totally available to you at any time. You know, you can have carrots all day long if you want. Donuts you can never ever have, because it's unacceptable. We don't have that at home. And then pizza we have every once in a while. Mm-hmm. And so using that, whatever that is for your family, using that in terms of tech and saying, right. you know, whatever very ad heavy Candy Crush type games are our donuts. They are the donuts of our family. We do not ever consume that because it can do A, B, C, D. So really having that conversation and putting together that, it's almost like a narrative. It's almost like a story mm-hmm. of your family and of what your values are, and continuing to have these conversations with your kids. And again, what I can tell parents from what I've seen out there is that it's more than doable. And mm-hmm. if you share it with children in a certain way and you present it to them in a certain way, they will definitely buy in mm-hmm. to what you're saying, because again, it's something that you're doing together. And they, by the way, also need to be encouraged to keep track of you and to keep track of your own habits. And so one of the moms was telling me one of their rules was no devices in bed in the morning, at night, at any point. And one, I think morning maybe, her son came into her bedroom and she was on her phone. And so he jumped on, he took the phone and he kind of tapped her on the head, which of course she discouraged him doing. So physical violence is never encouraged. But he kind of smacked her on the head and say, hello, what are you doing? You're breaking one of our family rules. So right. so definitely be humble about your own tech use and yes. share with your kids when you struggle with tech use as well. And right. when you find it very difficult to follow the family rules that you all agreed on, because again, we all have a hard time with it. There's no need mm-hmm. to try and come across as being very in control and stoic in front of your kids when it comes to this. They need to see that vulnerability yes. because the kids of today are the ones who are going to be controlling the tech one day in yes. 10, 15, 20, 30 years. They're the ones who are going to be creating it. They're going to be designing it. They're going to be designing the AI of the future and the mm-hmm. Virtual reality of the future and all the wearables and integrating AI into our transportation transportation systems, in our cities, and all, you know, all these different things. They're going to be the architects of our world. They need to understand all the ups and the downs of technology, and the ins and the outs of it, so that they can then create a really much more, I hope, kind of mindful and create much more mindful and humane forms of technology in the future.
Yes. Yes. And I like how you mentioned the, well, there's the more active consumption, like if
sure.
you, the example that you had given was, you know, if you're planning a wedding and you have Pinterest on your phone,
yes.
then,
yes.
you know, you're actively researching and,
yeah.
and then the event has come and gone and you're just scrolling,
sure.
scrolling, you know, yeah. this passive, you know, boredom yeah. or whatever it is
yeah.
and taking notice of that, being aware of that and maybe yeah. removing Pinterest or,
sure.
or whatever. So it's, you know, the yeah. active, active use versus passive, just mm-hmm. mindless, you know, consumption. Yeah. And it is a yeah. consumption. I did hear somebody else mention to another author out there, you know, there's so much out there. How do you not consume it? And she said,
right.
you know, she's kind of living it and breathing it. And so she doesn't need to consume elsewhere.
Right. Right.
She is very connected on her own platform and has written
right.
a book and everything, and has a lot of people that follow her or whatever.
Sure.
But that for herself, she doesn't consume it in that sense. She uses right. it as for her work and to put yeah. out there content, but she
yes.
doesn't necessarily consume it for herself, which I think is
sure. And she knows the purpose of
yes.
why she's doing it. So it's being done for work. Whereas like in,
right.
in again, in that Pinterest example that you just mentioned, you lose track of what the purpose is. You
right.
don't really know what it is. Now, if say you happen to be again, one of your strengths is appreciation of beauty and excellence, or you're a photographer or you're a designer, I don't know, your child has a play coming up or a project or something like that. And you find that you actually still enjoy looking at a lot of these images because they're just pleasing to the eye, or they're inspirational to you, or you know, you can use them in I don't know, for something else, or you're into gardening, whatever it is, then by all means keep using it. Absolutely. But that example in my case I gave, because for me that was the case. I was using it for that short period of time. And as soon as I was done with it, I definitely disengaged from it because I noticed how easy it was to just keep going. And that's one reason why I personally have made the choice so far. Anyway, I've been making the choice to not go on Instagram
mm-hmm.
and to not use Instagram. And it's something that I'm constantly being kind of told off for not doing and encouraged to do by friends, by kind of business coaches who I speak to, and other professionals who say it's very good for work, and you have to meet your clients where they're at, and you know, all these different things. And you know, I'm sure that I would be able to develop, again, a mindful way of using it. But part of it is that I just don't want to have yet one more platform that I need to be present on and that I need to manage and so on. But on the other hand, the other thing also is that I think because, and again, you know, kudos to the guys who created Instagram. It's so user friendly, and that user interface is so good, and it's so smooth, and it's so elegant, and it flows so easily that when I use my friends' phones to check out their Instagram, I notice myself becoming that zombie of just going and going and going and keep going, and I want to see the next one, and I want to see more, because you know, it's all really either beautiful photos or shocking photos.
Mm-hmm.
Again, that's what's going to get your attention. It's all about attention. There's nothing else. And so you can't get enough of it. And especially visually, you know, visual stimulation is a huge thing for us as human beings. You know, that's what piques our interest. As soon as you see color and you see light and you see shimmer or you see contrast, you're drawn to it immediately. And the people who use Instagram very well use it exceptionally well. And so they really know how to pull you in. And again, one of the conflicts, I think, for a lot of people who are in this digital wellness space, just like me, is do we want to use the same mechanisms that these platforms are using in order to either gain new clients or share information. Like, is that what I want to be doing? Do I want to be using Instagram because I want to draw in people's attention? So there's a little bit of a conflict there, I think, for us who are in the digital wellness space, but I'm sure for a lot of other people as well, again, perhaps whose values just don't really align with that. Right. I think a lot of people do ask themselves that question as well. You know, do I want to be using this platform and this kind of method in right. order to draw attention?
Right, right. So I've loved our time together. What kind of future projects are you working on or upcoming appearances?
Sure. So let me think. There's a few interesting things. I'm in Eastern Europe at the moment. I won't be heading back to New York until about February of 2020. So a lot of the things that I'm planning are going to be happening kind of from in next year. One of the things that I'm working on that is, so, I mean, in a way, all of this for me is connected, but it stands out a little bit from a lot of the other work that I'm doing, is I've developed it's a short 1.5 hour program that combines art and mindfulness. and self-work and trance work as well. So people who are familiar with hypnotherapy know are familiar with the concept of trance. And so that's a program that I've created that I've piloted so far, again, in New York, that I'm hoping to kind of put out there in a much bigger way in 2020. So that's one thing. And then there are a few other things that I'm working on as well. Again, I work with a number of different organizations that are all focused on a lot of these things that I've talked about today. Mm-hmm. So one of them is 6 Seconds, which is a really wonderful EQ-focused organization whose mission is to have 1 billion people practicing emotional intelligence around the world. And so I have ongoing things with these guys. I volunteer to deliver workshops for them quite frequently. They just did a whole series of global pop-ups in November for the International Children's Day. And I helped to co-create a really fun game that's called Tech Attack with a lovely woman called Patty, who's their marketing director. We created a game basically that kind of informs and educates kids about their brains, about the way their brains develop on the one hand, and on the other hand, how technology feeds into or plays into or kind of tries to take advantage of some of those aspects of their brain, like novelty seeking, for example. So how different forms of tech do that. And so we've created a fun little game that's available to be downloaded free on the 6 Seconds website. So I would encourage parents and teachers and principals at schools to have a look at that. I can share the specific link with you in case it's a little bit hard for our listeners to kind of manually search for it. Okay. So that's one thing. There's also a workshop that I'm working on for parents, again, in New York, with a friend and colleague of mine who's a mindfulness teacher. So we'll be rolling that workshop out again in 2020. That's going to be looking at, again, raising awareness for parents on tech use and really helping them figure out kind of how we can understand our kids better in terms of what their behavior is, what some of, again, their character strengths are, and then how that can lead to certain strengths and vulnerabilities when it comes to using technology, so that we can really, again, create a much more kind of custom designed approach to each child. I think that's one of the problems that we run into a lot, those of us who work in the digital wellness field, is that you will have parents who will come to you and say, I want an outline, I want guidelines. I want you to tell me do this and don't do this and do it this much for that long from that time until that time. And while the American Pediatric Association does have these guidelines, and I encourage everybody to check them out and to try and follow them as much as possible, what we often find is that it really isn't a one size fits all.
Right.
And you really do need to spend a little bit of time thinking about that specific family and that specific child. So what this workshop is about really is doing that, getting groups of parents into small groups where myself and my colleague can really dedicate that attention to them and really help them to craft something that's really going to make sense for them and their kids. I also kind of work with the New York chapter of the Center for Humane Technology. We're just kind of revamping some of the events that we organize now and are preparing for some new and exciting things in 2020. I'm also the co-leader of the Parenting Professionals Group in the Campaign for a Commercial-Free Childhood. That's another organization that I really encourage parents to check out. So the Campaign for a Commercial-Free Childhood. They do a lot of work on raising awareness around, again, commercialization of products, advertising to children, and things like that. And they're doing some really important work in that area. And then there's some potential kind of other projects maybe coming along in 2020 as well that maybe I'll keep to myself for now. But again, if people would like to get in touch with me, they can always go to my website, find out a little bit more information about my work at topcoaching.com. Definitely feel free to send me an email or a message. I'll always make sure that I reply as quickly as I can.
Awesome. So TEOP coaching for Teodora.
Yes.
So TEOPcoaching.com.
That's right.
Excellent.
Yes.
It has been so enlightening and I've just loved our conversation. I've learned a lot. And thank you for your time. I really appreciate
it. Of course, Laura. Thank you so much. I'm glad we managed to get together. Again, like you said, it's always a little bit challenging, especially where children are involved, to try and sort out schedules, especially kind of this time of the year. But again, I really appreciate you inviting me to do this. I think it's such an important topic. I think all of these kind of subtopics are incredibly important as well. And again, I hope that that a lot of our listeners, especially if they're parents, would have found some useful just kind of some useful ideas, maybe some useful tips, maybe some kind of perspective shifts as well. I always like to help people shift their perspective a little bit more as opposed to just kind of outright telling them do this or don't do this. Because I think, again, I always approach people from that strengths-based perspective. I think people already have a lot of resources, or if not all the resources that they need inside of them. Sometimes it can just kind of take a little bit of outside help to activate them. So so I hope that's what we managed to do, at least for some of our listeners today.
Yes. Thank you so much.
Of course.